a lot of people think when you go into retreat, you're kind of leaving the world behind and you're on some kind of vacation. But in fact, what happens is that everything you actually try to avoid, you know, your own loneliness or your own kind of learning how to appreciate and enjoy the energy of your mind, we avoid that a lot by distracting ourselves when we're out in the world. So how do we enjoy what arises in our mind, even the more difficult things? And this is the question that comes up when you're sitting alone in a cabin.
Elizabeth Mattis Namgyel, described as one of the extraordinary women shaping Buddhism in the West. She did a 6-year solitary retreat. That's coming up a little later in the program. Welcome to The Spirit of Things on RN and on your pod. I'm Noel Debien. In this episode, Buddhism through the eyes of modern Buddhist reformers. Why bombs in a Buddhist episode? Well, in 2016, a Taiwanese warship mistakenly launched a supersonic missile, killing a person on a fishing ship and injuring 3 others. The missile hit that fishing boat right next to Chimei, a little island between Taiwan and China. The whole thing nearly ended up a major international incident. My first guest today was meditating and working with great focus on that very same Chimei Island. He was producing a major new translation of the Buddhist scriptures into English. Ajahn Bhante Sujato is now an ordained Buddhist monk. He's Australian, he's tall, he's engaging, and he's a serious Buddhist reformer, including on women's rights. Well, leaving international incidents aside for the moment, I asked Bhante Sujato about his saffron-coloured Buddhist monk's robe, which I'd heard was the same one he wore when he met Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II.
They are indeed. I have washed them since then. But, yeah, we in our tradition, we just have one set of robes that we wear. We sort of patch them up as long as we can. And if we go to meet the Queen or whatever, then we just wear the same thing.
Tell us about Theravada Buddhism. Right. We shouldn't make any assumptions here about knowledge. So, Theravada.
Theravada Buddhism is a form of Buddhism which is practiced in South and Southeast Asia, primarily Sri Lanka, Thailand, Myanmar, and some other countries. I was ordained in Thailand, so I ordained and sort of primarily practiced within a Theravada tradition. But for myself personally, I don't really see myself as Theravadan as such. I just see myself as a follower of the Buddha, and I try to practice his teachings as I can.
Am I right in remembering that Theravada means the religion of the elders?
That's right, exactly. It means the doctrine or the teaching of the elders. Essentially, all the forms of Buddhism hark from the Buddha and hark from the same traditions, and they all develop various differences and so on in later times. What I focus on in my scholarly work is on those scriptures which are common to all of the traditions, and so those are the ones which are most likely to go back to the time of the Buddha himself.
In one sense, it's quite a radical step to become a monk, a bhikkhu,
right.
I think is the correct
term. Bhikkhu, exactly.
How do you go from, I think you were in a rock band, were you? Is that right?
Something like that, yes.
You went from rock band to Buddhist monk. Can you tell me a little bit about that trajectory?
Well, I was in a band called Martha's Vineyard, who had a bit of notoriety in the kind of indie music scene around the late 80s.
Mm.
Yeah. So that was good, and I really enjoyed it and got a lot out of that. That band broke up, and I did various things after that. But I reached a point where I didn't know what to do anymore, and the things that had been giving me joy, I didn't find the same kind of joy in them anymore. And these days I would say, yes, that's an existential crisis. And what's the meaning of life? What am I doing here? So I went on a journey and I ended up in Thailand and I ended up becoming a monk.
And what was the chain of events in Thailand that leave you sitting before me in a Buddhist monk's robe?
Honestly, much more straightforward than you might think, because if you're in Thailand, number one, there's temples everywhere. And the other thing, of course, as a musician, the thing that I share in common with monks is having no money.
So you've already practiced poverty. Yes, I see.
Definitely practiced poverty. So I was in Thailand with very little money, and they said, the monastery's free for doing retreats. I said, I'm in. So I went to the monastery and stayed there for a month doing meditation. That was absolutely transformational, you know, just to see all kinds of things that we use words, you know, like a word like peace of mind. And I remember halfway through that retreat and just sitting, having a cup of tea in the evening, and thinking to myself, ah, that's what that means. That's what a peaceful mind is actually like. And I'd never realized that before.
Because it strikes me, if you're in an indie band, the lifestyle and experiences that is fairly highly charged. I mean, I know it's up and down, but performance involves a fair amount of emotional, intellectual energy and output, doesn't it? The opposite of what you're actually involved in a monastery going inwards, I would have thought.
In some respects, yes. But also I think there's a lot of similarities. I mean, music takes a lot of discipline. And you have to have quite a lot of solitude to be able to be a musician, right? You have to be able to say no to people and go into your bedroom and sit there and practice. At the same time, when you play, you have to forget about all that. All the years of practice have to go and you just have to be with the music. And to me, that's very much like meditation, much like spiritual practice. You know, you have to do all the learning and teach yourself what this path is about and what the philosophy is about. But when you're meditating, you have to leave all that behind. You know, you just have to be in that moment and with the reality of what's in your mind at the time.
In Thailand, when you came to the monastery, can you describe what was the daily routine? You know, what time do you get up? What happened in that month you were with them?
That monastery offered intensive retreats, and so we were meditating 12 to 14 hours a day.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was pretty intense, and especially at the end of the retreat, they get you to meditate without sleeping for like 4 or 5 days. I don't recommend this, okay? You're looking shocked at the moment.
It sounds like an altered state of consciousness.
A number of very altered states of consciousness, yes. But normally monastic life is much more gentle than that. Usually get up early, maybe do some meditation, some chanting, have some breakfast.
When you say early, you mean 8, do you, or something like that?
4.
Right, so before sunrise, you're saying?
Usually, yeah. It varies from place to place.
But for you, we're talking like a sunrise, which is, they call it the matutinal hours in Christian tradition, which is before the sun has risen. And then what happens when you get out of bed? What do you do in your monastery, your particular experience?
So I'll talk about the monastery I stayed at, which is a forest monastery. We would get up, I think it was it might have been 3:30 or something. Anyway, early. And we would usually go to a hall and we would chant in Pali for half an hour. So Pali is the scriptural language of Theravada Buddhism, and it's essentially a cousin of Sanskrit. And then we would sit meditation. We'd do like a simple ceremony, so some simple bowing, lighting candles and things like that. But in the forest tradition, there's very little kind of ritual and ceremony, just a few simple rituals we would do during the day, but nothing too complicated. If you're too sleepy, which, yes, often I was, then do some walking meditation. When that's finished, we would prepare the main hall, take our robes and our alms bowl, and then we would walk into the village and collect alms. And so the villagers would come out and put rice in the bowls. Then we would bring that back and that would be our meal for the day. The rest of the day we would do some chores, have some time to ourselves for meditation and study. And then in the evening we might have another group gathering, share a cup of tea or coffee, have a discussion, and then maybe some more meditation in the evening.
I wondered about the eating pattern because you said you begged in the mornings, that the alms went out in the morning.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that in some monasteries the monks ate before midday and that was it. Was that the practice where you were?
That's right, yeah. In Theravada Buddhism, they only eat in the morning. So you either have one or two meals in the morning time. Yeah.
Now, you decided to seek ordination. You're an ordained bhikkhu, an ordained monk. But can you just first tell us what that is? Because some people have different views of what ordination is, depending on where they come from.
Sure.
Catholics or Anglicans, you're being made a deacon or a priest. It's a very particular thing. Is that similar to what we're talking about?
It's similar in that there's a particular procedure that you go through to become ordained. In all of the traditions of Buddhism, they share a very similar procedure. The core of that tradition is very similar and it's very simple and it's been passed down since the time of the Buddha. And the core of that is that there's a monastic community who makes a decision to accept a new member of their community. And once you've been accepted within that community, then that's considered as a valid ordination right across Buddhism.
Well, what's the actual action? Are you touched? Is there something done to you? What is the thing that ordains you?
No, there's no touching or anything, but it's a motion and 3 announcements. It's a legal procedure, yeah. A group of monks will say, we're putting forward this motion. We want to accept so-and-so into the community, and so-and-so is the mentor, and this is the procedure. If everybody's okay, everybody stay silent. If you have any objections, please speak. And they wait for a moment, and then they repeat that 3 times, and then at the end, you're in.
in preparing for this, I had a little look at one of the ordination rites, and I realised there's different schools of Buddhism, and right. this may or may not apply to you, but I do want to ask it. This came out of a thing called the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha, and it talks about the questioning over four offences that could lead to expulsion. Have you violated chastity? Right. Have you taken a life?
Yeah.
Have you ever stolen? Have yeah. you lied about your spiritual attainments? Right. Have I got that right?
That's exactly right.
You were asked this?
Oh, yeah.
And you had to say?
No.
Definitely not.
Definitely not.
And yeah. I presume this is ritual, so they would have checked you out as well. You've got no criminal record. Is that done too?
That is part of it, yes. Yeah. In the time of the Buddha, even that happened, that criminals would try to join the community to escape prosecution. Or to escape the draft, these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and then these kinds of, like those four basic parajika rules are taught to the new candidate. And so these are like the four kind of red lines. So if you cross any of those, then you're kicked out. That's it. You're finished.
Well, the word is defeat, I read. Yeah. Defeat. What does that mean to you as a Buddhist? Defeat.
It's a slightly, perhaps overly literal translation, but...
You're fired.
Basically, it means you're fired, really. Yeah, it means you're out. You can still stay in the community as a novice, but you can't take full ordination if you commit one of those offences while you're ordained.
Now, that's interesting because certainly within Christian traditions of monasticism, right. that's in the East among the Copts or right. the Orthodox or the Catholics or the Anglican monastic orders, you can be forgiven. Even murderers can be taken on if right. there's a sign of complete repentance.
Yeah, you can be forgiven, and if you committed those things beforehand, you're okay.
It's only once you're ordained.
Once you're ordained, you can't commit them, yeah.
Interesting, so the principle is therefore similar. You could have right. done something terrible, repented and...
Murder, anything like that's fine, as long as you're not going to do it while you're a monk.
I'm sure it's not fine. I understand what you mean. Well,
there are cases like that, and the famous case of Angulimala was a serial killer in the time of the Buddha and was taken on and ordained as a monk.
Now, I also want to ask you about the gendering of the rite, because I've been reading about this too. Certainly in the Tibetan tradition, you would be asked, are you a man?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have all the necessary bits that a man must
That's
have?
That's right, yeah.
You're not a eunuch?
Yes.
You're not a hermaphrodite?
Yes.
And you're not a despoiler of nuns? You'll be asked?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And are you a magically created phantom? Can you deny
uh-huh.
this?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Now, does that sort of thing happen within the Theravada tradition as well?
That sort of thing, yeah. The questions are a little bit different from the ones you just said, but it's similar, yeah. So you asked if you're a man, you asked if you're a human being, just in case. This is like a kind of a checklist.
Yes.
The thing about being a eunuch is a problematic one, and one that I've done a little bit of research on recently. The thing that we're translating as eunuch doesn't quite mean eunuch.
Oh, what does it mean?
The Indian word is pandaka, mm-hmm. and it's a bit difficult to figure out exactly what it means, but it's at least partly behavioural.
Right.
So it's partly...
Give us a hint. What's the behaviour that you're talking about?
Well, for example, sometimes it'll say you're a pandika on the half moon and not on the full moon.
What does that mean? Now I'm
well, exactly.
more confused. That sounds like a koan to me.
It does, exactly. So we're looking at it and we're thinking, what exactly does that mean? A werewolf, perhaps?
Oh.
I don't know. And so there are these interpretive difficulties to actually figure out what it really meant. But it's at least partly a sort of a culturally determined category. Another part of the thing was that you enjoy being besprinkled.
Besprinkled? What's
yes.
that about?
Well, perhaps certain acts of lovemaking that involve being sprinkled in some way.
Oh, I've read about those. So the Buddhist thought about this.
The Buddhist texts go into quite a lot of detail into these questions.
Well, I'm quite surprised.
Now he's looking interested.
And I want to talk to you about that. We don't often label the Buddhists with the same sort of weird moniker that we do Catholics. You're celibate. How mm-hmm. could you do that? Isn't that unnatural?
Isn't that weird, yeah.
But you are a celibate, aren't you?
Of course,
you?
Yeah.
You must be. You must yeah. renounce.
Yes, yes, of course, yeah.
And how did you get your head around that? You're in an indie band, hello?
Yeah.
Women throwing themselves at your feet.
Oh, that's right. That's what it's like. If you're a musician, never, no. It's bad. The reality is perhaps not quite that. But in any case, yes, it's a difference. I guess the thing is for me that it was led by happiness. When I went to the monastery, I meditated. I found myself just to be happier than I'd ever had been. And so that for me was the primary thing. Like, can I go further down this path and find a deeper sense of happiness and joy?
Well, let me just pursue that a little bit more because, of course, we Australian audiences, we do always want to ask you the stuff about sex because it sells everything and everybody's interested.
Of course, I understand.
But I read in the Buddhist traditions there's a fair bit of carefulness about the body and maintenance of respect for the body, including for you, what you can do, what you can show, where you can touch, where you can be touched. There's quite a code I saw in what was called the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha, say for the nuns. Okay. Let me give you an example. It may not be the same in your tradition, but it says, should any bhikkhuni lusting consent to a lusting man's rubbing?
Right.
Rubbing up against, taking hold of, touching or fondling below the collarbone and above the circle of the knees, she is defeated and she can no longer be in affiliation.
Right.
That's pretty direct. Here on, I can just see it, collar, knees, don't touch, you're out.
That's
Do you have similar...
That's right, yeah, we have a similar rule in our code of conduct, The thing with monastic codes is that they start out very simple. And when it starts out, the Buddha just sort of says, okay, anyone want to come follow me? You want to come and follow? That's great. You know, let's live together, do some meditation, and let's follow this path. And everyone's happy. And then more people come, and everyone's still happy. And as you go on, more and more people come in, and eventually people start messing around, and they start misbehaving. Certain Buddhist monastic law is laid down on a case-by-case basis.
Right.
Somebody does something bad, mess around, and so the Buddha will say, all right, let's make a rule about that. And Buddha actually initially refused to do that. When he was first asked to lay down the monastic law, he refused. Only when it's really necessary do we do it.
You can work it out, basically, use your common sense. Well, we talked about food, begging early in the morning, not eating after midday. We've talked about collarbone, knees, no-go in the area inside there. You don't own anything much except what you're wearing. That all sounds pretty tough, but I'm not looking at a twitching person who's in desperate need of some sort of help. You look quite peaceful. You emanate it. All that renunciation, can you explain it for somebody like me who hasn't done it? How does it work?
I don't know, honestly. What can I say? 3 days ago, I was in Singapore, and somebody invited me for lunch, and we went for lunch at this restaurant in some big shopping mall in Singapore, and I'm walking through this shopping mall, and I'm seeing all of these shiny shops and handbags and things, and I'm like, why? Why does anybody like all this stuff? So for me, this is the mystery, is why people get caught up in all these things.
You feel as if this is your path.
Yeah.
Is that how it feels?
It just feels how I live.
You're with The Spirit of Things on RN and however you get your podcasts. I'm Noel Debien, and my guest today is Bhante Sujato, an Australian Buddhist monk, reformer and teacher of the Theravadan tradition. And he's one of the founders of Sutta Central website, where you can find his latest English translations of sacred Buddhist texts. Can we just jump back to a question I asked you before, the schools of thought in Buddhism?
Yes.
And a lot of us know Theravada Mahayana, the religion of the elders, the great vehicle is the other one, I think. I'm talking 101 for dummies. What's the basic difference between you as a Theravadan and a Mahayana Buddhist?
It's a difficult question to answer because there's like a dogmatic answer, if you like, that I could give from either perspective.
Go there. Well, give us that one first.
The Mahayanists would say that the Mahayana is a teaching of greater compassion, and which is for the benefit of all sentient beings. And they would say the Theravada, they're only concerned about themselves. If the Mahayanists were to make a critique of Theravada, that was what they would say.
Right.
And the Theravadins, if they were to make a critique, they would say, oh, the Mahayanists, what they're following isn't really the teaching of the Buddha, and our teaching
they've added on.
They've added all these other things, and what we're teaching is the real deal. Well, both of those things are not entirely wrong, but they also badly fail to capture the richness and complexity of the living traditions. You know, the reality is that if you go to a Theravada country, like when I was in Thailand, and the kind of the reputation is that these monks only care about their own salvation, but the reality is that in the villages and the temples, they're acting constantly for helping the community and all kinds of social work and looking after kids and looking after the environment and looking after the village happens through the temple.
Can we talk about Santi Forest Monastery in Bundanoon in Sydney, where you were abbot?
I led this
community. Tell us about that place.
I inherited that property, which had been in use for a meditation centre for a number of years. I started running it as a forest monastery from about 2003. We build very simple huts, and we just stay in those huts mostly for the day. The rest of our lifestyle, you know, we maybe do some chanting and some meditation together. and we have discussions and work in the community. But when all of that's finished, then we have that place in the forest that we can go back to and just keep to ourselves and keep some quiet and solitude. And that's really the core of the forest monastery life.
You were abbot, so the leader. What did that involve? What were your duties as an abbot?
The main decisions we make is to appoint a sangha officer to do certain things. So we might say, okay, you're in charge of building, you're in charge of receiving guests. And once they've been asked to do that job, then their decisions should be respected within their sphere.
Let me bring you back to abbot. What does the abbot do in the middle of all that?
Abbot tries to make sense of it and tries to keep everybody on track and tries to teach meditation, listen to everybody's problems. On occasion, tell someone to walk out the door and don't come back.
You are defeated. Off you go. You are defeated.
From time to time.
You're fired.
Yeah.
So you left it, though, in the end, didn't you?
Yeah.
You moved on. Why?
Ultimately, it was really because I didn't feel it was my vocation.
Abbot wasn't high on your list of aspirations for your future life, is what you're saying.
Something like that. I actually really enjoyed it, but I felt that the community deserves somebody who's more invested in building a community, which is not something which was high on my priorities.
It's now a place for nuns, chiefly.
That's
though,
right. Bikinis, yes.
Though. Now, how did that happen? Was it male and female when you were there, or what was
it
the story?
It was, yeah. And it still is. I mean, monks can still stay there, but bikinis lead the community. For the past quite a number of years, so I've been one of a group of monks and nuns in Theravada Buddhism who's been working for the restoration of full ordination of nuns. This is in some way similar to the female ordination developments in Anglican Church and so on.
Yes.
I've always been welcoming of fully ordained nuns and trying to build up a community of them and so on there. And then together with my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, and a number of others and so on, then we performed the first bhikkhuni ordination, first full ordination of nuns in Australia in the Theravada tradition.
I read about this.
You're right.
That guy.
I'm that guy.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm the troublemaker. Yeah.
It's a big cultural change. Is it restoring something from the past, or
is
it an innovation?
Yeah, the bhikkhuni lineage was established by the Buddha. And it's always been continued, especially in the East Asian sphere, in China, Korea, Vietnam. They have very strong bhikkhuni lineages. So it's not as if it's sort of disappeared or that the memory of it has vanished. But it certainly is a big shift in terms of acceptance from the heads of the monk patriarchies in the different countries.
If you look at it, you know, in the cold, hard light of day between the monks and the nuns, I note from one of the scholars I was reading on this, that you as a monk have four principles that could entail defeat.
Right.
But sister over here has eight.
Mm.
She has double the number of things that can defeat her.
Right.
And you have in your monastery, I think, 99 rules which regulate. And in a female monastery, there are 116. There's extra. Is this telling us something about the history of male-female relations within some parts of the Buddhist movements?
Yeah. And this is an area of research that I've pursued myself.
Yes.
Translating, studying these texts and so on, doing the comparative studies and trying to figure out these questions exactly, like why are there more rules in one case than the other? And one of the things to bear in mind is that those differences are not just one way. Yes, there are those differences, but there are also some other differences. For example, there's one rule for the monk's vinaya, monk's discipline, which says that if a woman makes a credible accusation of sexual misconduct against a monk, then she must be listened to and the monks must investigate it. And if it turns out to be correct, then that monk must be treated according to the sexual misconduct that he's actually carried out. And there are other rules, for example, that say a monk cannot give his robes to a nun to do the laundry.
Oh, that makes sense to me.
It makes sense to me as well, right? There are provisions that are there to protect the nuns. There are other ones where you look at it and you say, well, look, that doesn't look very fair. So it's a matter of sort of trying to sort of find some kind of balance.
Well, you've just also come out of a solitary retreat translating sacred Buddhist texts. What were these texts you've been working on?
Okay, so I've been, for the last 2.5 years, staying on a little island off the coast of Taiwan called Jimei and translating the four Nikayas of the Pali Canon. So the Pali Canon is one of the sacred scriptures of Buddhism, especially of the Theravada school. And the four Nikayas would be comparable in importance to the Gospels in Christianity, being the sort of the key record of the Buddha's teachings.
While you were in Taiwan, something odd happened, though, didn't it, to do with the government, I believe. What disturbed this monk's peace? What happened?
Well, you know, I'm on a little, tiny little island, which is halfway between Taiwan and China, one of the busiest waterways in the world, right? Nothing much happens on this island. But the only kind of event of international significance was when a poor mechanic, I believe, working on a ship in the Navy Yards in Taiwan, accidentally pressed the wrong button and a missile got fired and blew up a fishing boat just near my island where I was at.
That would disturb one's meditation.
It was okay. I mean, I didn't.
Did you hear it?
I didn't hear it myself, no, but it was not far away. Fortunately, the Chinese didn't respond, so that was a relief to everyone. Yeah. And there, I've been involved in translating the Buddhist text, specifically the four Nikayas of the Pali Canon.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything with you you could give us an example of?
I do. I would have to just open my computer, so it would just be a minute.
That's fine. So you've got your laptop there. That's good.
I have, yeah. Renunciation has its limits, you know, you've got to be reasonable.
Well, I was wondering if all the monks get a lovely laptop like that.
I'm very lucky because I do develop the website, so I get to have one. Anyway, so I've been on this island and translating the four Nikayas of the Pali Canon. And that's a major project. It's the first time that the four Nikayas have ever been translated together, where they've been translated consistently throughout the whole thing and where they're going to be released in the public domain. So they're not going to be, you know, we're not going to be charging people for books or anything like that.
But this is high-level scholarship, in other words, you're talking about here.
It is, yeah, yeah.
So can you give us a little example? Give us a taste so we know what you're doing.
Okay, so this is a short excerpt from a sutta called the Udumbarika Sihanada Sutta, the Lion's Roar in the Udumbarika Monastery. And this was a conversation between the Buddha and an ascetic who was a follower of one of the other religions at the time of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buddha has just given this particular ascetic an extensive teaching on different aspects of spiritual life. And then he finishes off with quite a nice passage on how different religions relate to each other. So this is the Buddha speaking, and he's speaking to the ascetic called Nigrodha. Nigrodha, you might think the ascetic Gotama speaks like this because he wants pupils. But you should not see it like this. Let your teacher remain your teacher. You might think the ascetic Gotama speaks like this because he wants us to give up our recitation, our sacred scriptures. But don't see it like this. Let your sacred scriptures remain as they are. You might think the ascetic Gotama speaks like this because he wants us to give up our livelihood. But let your livelihood remain as it is. You might think the ascetic Gotama speaks like this because he wants us to start doing things that are considered bad in our tradition. Or he wants us to give up those things that are considered good in our tradition. But you should not see it like that. Let those things that are considered good or bad in your tradition remain as they are. I do not speak for any of these reasons, Nigrodha. There are things that are unskillful and corrupted that result in suffering in old age and death. I teach so that those things may be given up. And when you practice accordingly, corrupting qualities will be given up in you and cleansing qualities will grow. You'll enter and remain in the fullness and abundance of wisdom, having realized it with your own insight in this very life.
So I'm listening now, if I understand what you've just told me, to words which are believed to be from the Buddha himself?
From the Buddha himself, yeah.
And this text that you've just translated, are there different versions of the translation? And is there dispute over how it should be translated?
This particular one, there are, of course, different translations. Not particularly. This particular passage is pretty straightforward. Yeah.
But there are others which you're working on which were not so straightforward, I presume.
Other texts, for sure, yeah. There's always problematic passages. But the Pali scriptures as a whole are fairly well understood and fairly textually clean. Yes, of course, there are always difficult passages. It's a 2,500-year-old scripture. But for the most part, it can be translated fairly readily.
So if you drop into Sri Lankan Buddhist monastery or you drop into an American Buddhist monastery or an Australian or an Indian, will you find consistency with the texts, the Pali texts?
Yes. The Pali texts themselves are very consistent from one tradition to the other. We do make critical additions and, of course, you note varied readings and things like that from one to the other, but they're usually very minor. In fact, they're almost invariably very minor.
Bandar Sajjada, could I ask you what might seem like an odd question, in fact, even a disrespectful question maybe, because we think of Buddhism, if I put on my big rubber hands, as peaceful. It's non-violent. Ahimsa is a word that comes to mind, even though that's a Gandhi word, but it's also a good Buddhist word, non-violence. Mm. Yet I know, and I've been reading in preparation for this, that there are some exceptions to this. And this may shock people, but like in Myanmar, there's a thing called the Democratic Karen Buddhist Army, where these are headed by monastic leaders, and there have been attacks on Muslims, like thump, bang, kill. And in Sri Lanka, there are some Buddhist monks who've embraced violence as a means to target Tamil, Christian and Muslim minorities. And I'm thinking of the Buddhist power force. Now, how do you, as a monk, in learning and in practice, make sense of aberrations, I presume, like that? Where does that come from?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously horrifying and it's devastating. It's devastating to think of the suffering that these things create. As always, it's the poor and the powerless who end up suffering the brunt of these kinds of things. And these are forces driven by a sort of a misguided nationalism, you know, just like in a Christian country. Mm. Lots of people might write they're a Christian on their census form. But
they'll still bomb Hiroshima if needed.
Yeah. Are they genuinely following the way of Jesus is another question altogether.
World War I and World War II, I believe they were Christians on both sides.
And Buddhists.
So you're talking about human nature, in other words.
Human nature, yeah. I think it's important to remember that in those countries, a lot of Buddhists are horrified by when they see these things happening. It's not like that's
normal.
Yeah, so that's normal. It's also, I think, important to recognize that how much of the perception is still driven by the media's surprise, just like you expressed there. And this is something I read and find very annoying in the papers. And they will say, Buddhist villagers attacked these things.
Yes.
Would they say Christian villagers attacked a place?
Depends on who's writing the newspaper.
Depends who's writing the newspaper.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were villagers, and yes, they identified as Buddhists, but it doesn't really have anything to do with what they're doing. But as far as I know, the monks have been involved in inciting and organizing things, but they're not involved in actually doing the violence themselves. I may have missed something, but as far as I know, that's still the case. That's not to excuse them, but it's just to understand the situation.
But they're not armed themselves. These are not gun-toting Buddhist monks.
I believe so, yeah. Mm. And in Myanmar, the mainstream Buddhist organizations have disavowed these movements.
Right.
And Buddhist organisations in Australia, the Australian Sangha Association, the Federation of Australian Buddhist Councils and other organisations have disavowed these groups and movements as well. So it's horrifying, and what's happened to the Rohingya is horrifying, and we need to do better.
Bhante Sujato, I have to ask you about Sutta Central.
Okay. Yes.
What is that?
Sutta Central is a website that I've been involved in for a number of years, where we host early Buddhist texts, translations of those texts, and parallels, so all of the links between one text and the other. So the founders of Sutta Central is myself, Rod Bucknell, who's a retired Buddhist professor from the University of Queensland, and John Kelly, who many people wonder, but yes, John Kelly is Paul's brother.
Oh, right. So you're doing literary criticism of the scriptures?
That's right, yes. It's based on text critical study of the texts in Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan and Chinese.
Bhante Sujato, it was great to have you on The Spirit of Things.
Thank you so much.
Old Beach Road, a 1989 song there by the band Martha's Vineyard. Anthony Best was on guitar and harmonica. Who knew that Anthony Best would one day become a Buddhist teacher and reformer by the name of Ajahn Bhante Sujato? She's been described as one of the extraordinary women shaping the transmission of Buddhism in the West. Her name is Elizabeth Mattis Namgyel. She's the daughter of a music executive from California, and Elizabeth's life changed in her college years when she decided to answer the nagging question, what should I do with my life? Elizabeth travelled to Nepal. She found a spiritual path in Tibetan Buddhism. She also found an unconventional young Tibetan master who later became her husband. Now a Buddhist for more than 25 years, she's also on the advisory boards of Prism Mindfulness Network and the Buddhist Arts and Film Festival in the USA. In 1997, Elizabeth went on a solitary retreat for 6 years in the Colorado Rocky Mountains. Out of her period of solitude there came the germination of her new book, The Logic of Faith, exploring one of the central teachings of the Buddha. She's speaking with producer Jeff Wood.
Elizabeth Mattis Numgyel, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you so much, Jeff. So happy to be here.
Well, Elizabeth, you've been described as one of the extraordinary women shaping the transmission of Buddhism in the West. Why are women in particular playing such a prominent role?
Oh, just because we're interested. I don't know how to explain that exactly, but it seems to be the case.
Well, we'll talk more about Buddhism in the West shortly, but I want to take you back to 1997 and the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, where you spent 6 years in a retreat, a fairly solitary retreat, while raising your son at the same time. That sounds impossible, but you did it. Why were you on such a long retreat?
I was really, really in pursuit of understanding something about myself, my mind, and going deeply into the practice, which is very traditional in our lineage. My son was perhaps 7 when I went in, but I had a lot of support from our community and from my husband as well. And I had this opportunity and I just really took it up. And my son really enjoyed that it was happening. I had a little bed in there for him, but he stayed primarily down in the house, which was quite close. So he would come up and the time that we spent together was very quality time. And it was up in the mountains and we'd go for walks and spend, you know, really concentrated time together. And he used to say to me, "Mom, I'm really happy you're in retreat. I always know where you are." That's how he saw it.
Well, spending time alone with yourself can be quite confronting. Did it bring up challenges like that?
It brings up a lot of challenges. You see, a lot of people think when you go into retreat, you're kind of leaving the world behind and you're on some kind of vacation. But in fact, what happens is that everything you kind of actually try to avoid, you know, your own loneliness or your own kind of learning how to appreciate and enjoy the energy of your mind, the natural vitality and what comes up in the mind, we avoid that a lot by distracting ourselves when we're out in the world. So I actually really think this tradition is for those who are interested in looking at the nature of experience and learning how to digest it. You know, if you think of the analogy of food, ingesting food and processing and eliminating food, like we don't know how to do that with our own experience. We have a lot of trouble with experience. We struggle so much. And I always think, well, what is life but a stream of momentary experiences? And so how do we enjoy what arises in our mind, even the more difficult things? And this is the question that comes up when you're sitting alone in a cabin. And yet you have this incredible internal infrastructure to work with it, which is what the path is for.
Now, you're talking about the Buddhist path.
Yes.
Tell me about your tradition.
Well, let's see. My teacher is both a Mahayana and Vajrayana teacher. He's from Tibet, his tradition. He's born a refugee in India, northern India. And so by the time Tibetan Buddhism got to India, it was quite developed and developed further, deepened, and more commentaries and practices came from that tradition. The path itself is very gradual and progressive, and it takes you deeper in the path becomes more and more refined. So it took me a long time even to be able to get to the point where I was able to go and retreat and do the particular kind of practice that I did. There are 4 major schools in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and the school we practice is Nyingma, which means the oldest school, the old way.
Let's go back to the start. You're the daughter of a music executive in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And in your college years, you had a dream. It must have been quite a vivid and startling dream because you went chasing the images from that dream all the way to Nepal. Can you tell me that story?
I must have said that somewhere along the line, or I heard my mother said that, and I just have a vague recollection of that a dream about a peacock. But honestly, since I was very, very young, I had these experiences, and I don't want to make it sound like I was so unusual in these experiences. I think children have these experiences, and people have experiences of feeling very connected and very clear and resolved in the mind. Sometimes I call these experiences of grace, where you just feel very natural moving about the world, even if it's just for a moment. And for some reason, they affected me deeply. And I also had experiences of not feeling that way. And I always wondered what those were about and why I sometimes had that experience and why I didn't, until I finally, kind of in the gaze of studying anthropology, and I got a grant to study abroad. That's really what propelled me into kind of searching for something. You know, my main question was, why do I sometimes access this experience, and what is that about? And how can I maybe cultivate it, that experience, or how can I live like that? And why is it that sometimes there's so much confusion and discomfort in the mind, discontentment and so forth? And so I started to pursue a path. I didn't even really know what I was looking for. I started looking very actively for a teacher when I was in Asia.
Elizabeth, let's talk about that spiritual teacher that you did find, Dziga Kongtrul Rinpoche.
Very good.
I've been practicing.
That's really impressive. Most people can't say that.
Tell me about him.
Well, it was very surprising to meet a teacher who was 21 years old, and I was 23 at this time. And it's not what I had imagined. You know, you kind of, when you go to the East, you imagine meeting, you know, an elder with a long white beard and spectacles or something. But I had my questions. You know, I think I was trying to find a way to lead a life that was meaningful. You know, at 23, so I just got my master's degree, and I was trying to decide what I was going to do. But this question was always burning in me, how to find a way to be before I decide what I'm going to do. And so I started visiting all the great teachers that were in the area that I was in, mostly in Nepal, Kathmandu area. I was with my mother, actually, because my mother is a Buddhist, I didn't mention. And we went to meet a teacher named Tukul Orgyen Rinpoche. He was a lovely, warm, generous man who ran a nunnery up in the hill area. And he was giving some very profound instructions. So we were supposed to go off and just practice them during the break. And then my husband, who was to be my husband, came up, and he's dressed very plainly, a young man, very skinny. And he started to talk to me. And usually I wouldn't do that in Asia, because I was a young woman and I didn't engage so much when men came up. But there's something unique about him. And we started to talk about the Dharma, about Buddhism. And all of a sudden I started to understand many things. It was just a lot of things became clear about the instructions. And so I felt something. And so we just started to talk and we became friends. And I hung out with him, you know, off and on for that week. And didn't know he was born and recognized as a Rinpoche and trained very heavily throughout his life.
Just explain what a Rinpoche is for people listening.
Yeah. A Rinpoche, well, it literally means precious, someone who's precious. And the reason they're precious is because they study and they practice and they embody the Dharma. And he was very young, but he had such a deep devotion to the path, and it also studied a lot of philosophy and logic. Like, Buddhism is not just about faith and devotion, but about reasoning and looking deeply into things and having a direct experience. So when I met him, I had that experience of what I was calling grace or openness. And so at some point, somebody told me, and also most Rinpoches, they're abbots of monastic institutions, like he had a monastery in Tibet. But he had been a monk most of his life, and he had given back his robes, which is a bit of a radical thing to do. And so I met him at a kind of an interesting juncture in his life, because it's not an easy thing in the context of society that he grew up in to give your robes back. But he's very authentic with his path, and I think he didn't want to be deceptive.
And as you've mentioned, subsequently, you were married.
Yes, we were about a year later. I actually went home and sold my stuff and just moved right back. I had so much confidence. It was a very good move for me. It was perfect. You know, I was young and confused, but somehow had some sort of insight that this was the right thing for me to do because I trusted that experience.
You mentioned that Buddhism contains not just devotion, but insights based on reasoning and logic. And you've used that word in the title of your new book, The Logic of Faith, which is almost an oxymoron, that phrase.
Yeah.
It's really about one of the major insights of the Buddha, Pratichasamutpada.
Again, very good.
Very good. Which is, in your phrase, it's called dependent arising. Now, before we explain that, just tell me the story of the time you received your first teaching. I think it was on a small hill, again, in Nepal.
Yes. So I was maybe at 2 weeks or so after I had met my teacher. We went to a beautiful little village called Dulikhel, a little bit on the outskirts of Kathmandu, I guess. And we're sitting on this hill and we're looking out at this beautiful valley of, you know, rice paddies and houses, huts. And he turned to me and he put his two index fingers together. So let's see, we're on the radio. So I would say, like the roof of a house, the two index fingers pointing. And he said to me, he calls me Lizzie. He says, Lizzie, is this one or two? And I was really baffled by the question. I was thinking, one or two, what? But then I answered the best I could, and I said, well, you can't say the shape is one thing because it's two fingers that makes it, but it's not two either because it's this one shape. And he said, very good, very good. I have no idea why he was so excited or what it ever meant. I mean, it took me many, many years to understand the significance of this particular gesture, although he started to explain it to me that day, but it was puzzling at first. So let me connect it to the Buddha's insight. So when the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree, he had, at the dawn of his awakening, he had an insight into the nature of reality, I guess you could say. In a way, it's very simple and basic. It's nothing trippy about it. He said that everything has a cause. Everything comes into being and expresses itself and falls away due to causes and conditions. There's nothing you can possibly find that is not of the nature of causes and conditions. It's because of causes and conditions that everything moves. This is a paraphrase, because I think to repeat the sutras might be hard on the radio. In the sutras, he describes this by illustrating two bundles of reeds leaning up against each other. So basically, if one bundle of reeds falls, the other one will fall as well. So I often use the term everything leans to describe this phenomena, Pratichasamutpada, which is often translated as dependent arising, or I call it in my book, the nature of infinite contingency. But what it was really talking about is the infinite nature of relationship, that nothing happens in isolation, that everything is made of parts, and therefore everything is a constant state of movement. You know, if things weren't leaning, things would be inert. So this goes very deep, but one way to talk about it is it all depends. How's that for something easy to grasp?
Well, that sounds like a book title too.
Yeah, it could be. It all depends.
So this notion of dependent arising, of contingency, also plays a part in the Buddhist concept of the self, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It starts with the very beginning of the Buddhist teaching that we look into the nature of self because we're always thinking of me. And we always, whether it's conscious or not, have this strong feeling that there's a singular, permanent, separate self. Actually, you know, if you ask anyone, is a self permanent, everyone would say it was impermanent because we all know we're going to die. And yet there's this sense that there is this thing, there's something that continues. There's a continuum because if you look at a picture of yourself when you're a child, you will recognize your physical features. You know, something is continued. You know all of your life history. You were the one, you know, that was there your first day of nursery school when you're scared and kind of grabbing onto your mom's skirt. And you were the one who's still kind of narrating a story for yourself, like the first time you got jilted by someone or whatever. So there's a sense of continuum. So there's this deep, deep searching for the self. Because when you realize that the self is not some singular permanent thing, there's a liberation that happens. This is a really subtle idea, but I should probably explain that a little bit, what that means then. So first of all, there's nothing singular in the self. For example, in relationship to my son, I'm a mother. In relationship to maybe this interview, I'm a teacher. When I go to the dentist, I'm a patient. So what am I exactly? It all depends. It's very simple, actually. It's nothing really highfalutin or trippy. The Buddhist path is very practical, and it's based on direct experience. So, you know, we often cling to ideas about ourselves. For example, we might have an idea that, you know, an issue with low self-esteem. And that's just a concept that we cling to that's not helpful. But if we look a little deeper, we might find much more. We might find a longing to serve others, but feel our heart is kind of like a dry seed, but the longing is there. It's like if we start to look, we find so many things and we open up and we're not stuck in any particular place, which is very liberating. It means we're not doomed, that we have infinite potential.
Elizabeth, I mentioned earlier that you've been described as one of the major teachers shaping Buddhism in the West, the transmission of the Dharma in the West. It's a relatively modern and recent form of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, is there a difference in your mind between Western Buddhism and Buddhism in Asia, where it started?
Yeah, I think it's very different in many ways. I think we are very different. So I think that the Dharma, the Buddhism that I see in Tibet and Nepal and India and so forth, you know, people are born into a faith tradition. And most people don't do the philosophy and the study aspect or even the meditation. Mostly they do mantras. And there's just this sense of trust. That's, I think, why I wrote this book on faith, because I think faith is a really sticky issue. It's a very challenging issue for us in contemporary culture. I think for contemporary Tibetans, it's difficult too, for the young people. It's not as natural for us. I was reading this one writer, Sam Harris. He wrote The End of Faith. In one of his books, he said that we should use the word spirituality, but I don't think spirituality challenges us. Like, spirituality can be anything that suits our ego. But faith challenges us, because in fact, the human condition is such that we have to faith. We have to faith because we don't know. And there's some kind of humility and openness that's required for us to live in a sane way in that kind of condition, in the human condition. And yet, there's something very powerful about our ability to do that in the moments that we can do it or in the periods that we can do it. And I think it's possible for us to live like that. It's not a religious issue for me. It's a very human issue, the issue of faith.
Elizabeth Natis Nungyel is an American Buddhist teacher, practitioner, and author of The Logic of Faith. And thanks this week to producers Jeff Wood, Marion Chahab, and sound engineer Hamish Camilleri. Joe Gelanese is the manager of ABC Religion and Ethics. Music and guest details, including our first guest, Bhante Sajjato, will be on the Spirit of Things website, along with audio streaming or download. You can subscribe to our podcast using the ABC Listen app, and you can never miss anything that way. I'm Noel Debien. Next time, The Secret Life of Monks and Nuns. That's on the Spirit of Things here on RN.